Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Here's a news flash for you. It's hot. I live in Philadelphia, and here it gets hot and humid, so being outside feels like you're covered with a warm, wet blanket, or maybe like you've walked into the steam room at your gym fully dressed. There's a German saying that goes, geteiltes Leid ist halbes Leid. That means shared misery is half the misery. So how hot is it where you are? For example, Las Vegas.
It's so hot here this summer that when we see the temperature hit 105 degrees for a high, we think, huh, a cool day today.
Near Phoenix, Arizona, it's so hot
that I cooked an egg in direct sunlight in under 2 hours.
People are even sweating in San Francisco, California,
where summers are usually gloomy, but it's actually so hot right now, I'm burying my arms and legs in a sundress.
And we heard from somebody in Delhi, India.
The number of people turning on their air conditioning caused a power outage.
On today's show, stories of high temperatures and our efforts to deal with them. Generally, I do love summer. I love the long days, the more relaxed pace of living, iced coffee. And in Philly, we have a strong tradition of stoop sitting. That means spending time on your front steps, talking with your neighbors. But the thing is, even if you stay out there for a long time, long after dark, it is still so hot. Cities turn into heat-trapping islands in the summer, and that leads to more energy use for cooling, more air pollution, more public health issues like breathing problems and heat stroke. So Philadelphia is looking for solutions. Here's Irina Zhorov with more.
It was hot the day I met Ladine Durant. An air conditioner blew cold air in the living room, but we made our way to the second floor of her North Philadelphia house to see Birdie.
Hello, 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 hello.
Birdie is a blue crown conure and lives in a little room next to Ladine's bedroom.
Everything is okay, mommy. Okay.
There are no windows on the sides of Ladine's house, and he rises and gets trapped on the top floor. Birdie is a tropical parakeet, but it used to get so hot in Ladine's row house that Birdie couldn't handle it.
She'd be, you know, kind of gasping for air, and, you know, I'd spray her, but you could just see her panting, like, you know, with a little tongue out.
Ladine has asthma, and she had a hard time breathing, too.
If it's like 95 outside, it will feel like maybe anywhere from 100 degrees, maybe 100.
Overheated homes like Ladine's are a common problem in Philadelphia. To see where heat concentrates in the city, I sat down with a city planning professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
My name is Ken Steiff.
Ken used satellite data from a July day in 2016, when temperatures were in the 90s, to map the temperatures around the city. He found heat pockets.
We can see that there are certain areas, certain hotspots, that are hotter than others.
He zooms in on some black-roofed warehouses in North Philly. Black absorbs heat and can turn a building into a kind of solar oven. On the map, the warehouses glow bright red, indicating surface temperatures around 115 degrees. Ditto with the vast parking lots that surround the sports stadiums in South Philly. Temperatures in the low 100s spread out across the dense downtown like an orange bruise on the map.
Conversely, if you look in my neighborhood in West Philly, around the Woodland Cemetery and Clark Park, you can see it's much cooler.
West Philly is less dense and has a lot of trees. A large park in the western part of the city and the rivers appear as a nice cool green on the map, around 75 degrees.
Living vegetation, sort of like an air conditioning system. It brings water up out of the ground and then it evaporates it into the tree canopy. And so that has sort of a natural cooling effect.
That's Mark Imhoff, a scientist with NASA. He says if you zoom out across the region, the whole city glows hotter on the map than the suburbs and surrounding rural areas. This is called the heat island effect.
It was first perceived in London during the Industrial Revolution when London was growing very rapidly. People realized that it seemed to be much warmer in the city than it was in the outlying areas.
This is certainly true in Philly. This city was carved long ago into what used to be forest. Today, blocks and blocks of row houses face off along asphalt streets and cement sidewalks. It's an old city where houses are not well insulated and many people can't afford to pay for air conditioning. Parts of Philly are notably treeless. Ken Stife, the city planning professor, says in one neighborhood settled by Italians, people like to be able to see the bustle on the street and check on their neighbors out their windows, so trees didn't fit the culture. A lot of these things came to a head in the 90s when there was a series of heat waves.
Our top story, a brutal and potentially dangerous heat wave.
More than 100 people died. Many of them were elderly. Back then, ideas around healthier, greener cities were relatively new to city planning. This was before Philly developed a heat warning system, a tree planting program, and got a sustainability officer. Virtually every roof in the city was black. But the deadly heat waves drove change. And Mark, the NASA scientist, says there are things you can do to combat the heat island effect, in addition to adding greenery.
You know, different building materials, different roofing types will ameliorate urban heat islands.
In 2010, the city passed an ordinance requiring cool roofs for new construction. A nonprofit called the Energy Coordinating Agency started tackling existing older houses where homeowners couldn't afford to pay for the costly retrofits. Those repairs can run anywhere between $8,000 to $10,000. Remember Ladine Durant and Birdie? The agency installed a cool roof on her house last year.
Now, you know, it's pretty comfortable for me.
I was there as the nonprofit tackled another block not far from Ladine's house. The block has just a couple of trees on it, lots of cement. Workers were rehabbing two roofs.
Hi.
Ricardo Araujo is one of the residents who's getting help. I visit him in the morning, but the thermometer already reads 93 degrees. There's no air inside, he tells me. I ask how he and his wife deal with it. In the summers, they shower 2 to 3 times per day. He's wearing a tank top and has sweat dripping down his face. A surgery scar peeks out of his shirt. He's had heart surgery, so the heat agitates him. He needs fresh air, he says. I leave Ricardo and climb a ladder to the top of his house. A couple of roofers are finishing up the first layer of the cool roof coating. It's a rubberized paint, but importantly, it's white, which means it reflects heat rather than absorbing it.
This is how it's done.
This is how it's done. You just dip your roller in the material, and you smooth it on.
The key is evenly.
Nice, fine, even layers.
That's Frank Zimmerman. His boss, Rob Nalfi, often works with the energy nonprofit.
The key is to be generous with it. You do not want to be cheap with this. So a nice even coat, and you don't scrub it, you just keep dipping.
Dip it. Nice even coats. Make sure you cover all the black.
Rob looks out over the neighborhood. Most of the roofs here are still black, but around the city, about 40% of roofs are now reflective. Rob says he just bought a new house and applied a cool roof. His wife is happy with it.
She noticed that our bedroom was cooler. So, and she told me that she noticed a difference, and she's going through hot flashes, so, and she's cooler.
The Energy Coordinating Agency estimates if the city can get to 60 or 70% reflective roofs, that will help cool the whole city and drive down health risks and costs for residents. Back at my desk, I pull up a satellite image of Philadelphia. In some neighborhoods, black roofs still dominate. In others, white roofs spread across blocks with black just here and there. The aerial views make the streets look like piano keys. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Today's show is about heat, and I always love how many different ways weather forecasters have to say the same thing, that it's going to be hazy, hot, and humid. It's going to be blazing temperatures, a scorcher. And all of those weather reports from Pittsburgh, Fargo, or Atlanta, they are collected in real time, and that data finds its way to a library, a weather library of the world. There are actually three. One is in Germany, another one in Russia, and the other is in Asheville, North Carolina. And as Alana Gordon reports, you can learn a lot from what's stored there.
The German crew is really good at analyzing sea surface temperature.
The Russians do some really neat things with hydrological data, meaning precipitation and runoff and dealing with water.
And Deke Arndt says here at this World Weather Library in Asheville,
we're pretty good at global surface temperature,
as well as tracking droughts. Deke is chief of climate monitoring at this special branch of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's where this World Weather Library is based, and it contains very secure servers filled with information coming in from satellites and other sources from across the globe.
The operational weather community really gets along well internationally.
Yes, sharing data is encouraged.
And so when they have shared this data through the World Meteorological Organization, it ends up getting routed here after it's served its first purpose, which is to inform forecasts to protect life and property.
And like any good keeper of information, the library also has a locked room.
So behind this wall,
in the basement,
there's basically a series of just stacks and stacks, like your old, whatever school you went to, the old part of the library, except instead of old books, it's old boxes of old paper.
Stacks of boxes filled with handwritten weather observations, going back decades and beyond. In the old days, farmers, ranchers, dam operators, and others would fill out a form and mail it to the Weather Service.
So all of the observations that have been made officially in the last century or two, and we even have some going back to Thomas Jefferson, they find their way here and they live in active retirement.
And there is a very timely reason for maintaining this old weather information.
So it's just like any good story in anybody's life. You don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been, and science works that way too.
Deke says one hot or cold day doesn't mean much in itself. Day-to-day weather conditions fluctuate for all sorts of reasons. But collected over time, scientists can start to glean patterns and trends that reflect a bigger view about climate. Deke's been mining through that weather data, and his group recently found that this past June, for example, was the third warmest worldwide on record. And it's not just a one-off. June has been warming for many years. Several hundred miles north of Asheville, Michael Mann has been running statistics on this type of weather data, too.
I direct the Penn State Earth System Science Center.
He, too, has identified bigger climate trends, in part thanks to weather records.
We've seen a doubling of record heat here in the U.S. over the past half century. And so what we're seeing then is not the individual rolls of the dice. The individual rolls of the dice, that's weather. But when we see that the dice have been loaded so that sixes are coming up twice as often as they should, that's sort of an analogy for what we're seeing with climate change.
Mike says all of this with caution because he says it's important to avoid conflating weather and climate. Anecdotes and memories about weather at any given moment in time are powerful. It's human nature to attach one thing to some bigger trend. It's probably easier to remember that really big snowstorm as a kid, with snow up to your chin, or the one last year that trapped you inside for 2 days. You probably aren't taking note of that normal day. But over time, Mike's discovering important changes in those weather patterns, and more specifically, how it has gotten more extreme over time.
We're seeing a loading of the dice.
Severe thunderstorms in West Virginia last Thursday caused catastrophic flooding.
The water started to go down here around 9 a.m. yesterday, but it rose.
It's always hot in Texas in the summer, but this one has been like no other.
Heavy flooding is inundating southeast Louisiana.
It has been historic. We've
seen record floods, record length heat waves, record hurricanes. If you look at the underlying science of climate and climate change, what it tells us is that in each of these cases, we do expect to see more extreme events of those sorts as we continue to warm the planet.
Let's get an update on the wildfires in California. There are a lot of them.
Back in North Carolina, Deke Arndt says all of the climate insight that scientists are finding out now is critical information for our planet. And that makes those weather records, collected decades and even centuries ago by farmers and others, even more special.
I would love to go back to, you know, a farmer in Nebraska and say thank you for what you have done. You know, you may not know it now, but 80 years from now, there'll be this big topic of conversation called climate change, and the numbers that you wrote down diligently every day are going to help bring more clarity to that conversation. I really wish I could invent a way to go back and thank people for what they've done. Outside our door, in Nebraska land, sweet Nebraska land, upon thy burning soil I stand, and I look away across the plains, and I wonder why it never rains. Alana Gordon reported that story.
On a hot, sweaty day, it feels really nice to walk into a cool, air-conditioned room, and you kind of go like, with relief, right? But maybe you also feel a tinge of guilt. Air conditioners are not good for the environment. They use a lot of energy, and some of them emit a greenhouse gas called HFC, hydrofluorocarbon. So air conditioning contributes to climate change, and in many places, climate change leads to heat waves and higher temperatures, which means a greater demand for air conditioning. It's a vicious cycle. I talked to Anjali Jaiswal. She is with the environmental advocacy group, the National Resources Defense Council, and she told me this cycle is a problem in South and Southeast Asia, where large numbers of people living in poverty really suffer in increasing temperatures. So let's say there is a major heat wave in India, then people come to the hospital for heat-related symptoms, but then the hospital itself may also not be air-conditioned, right?
Right. So in 2010, when we started working, the hospital rooms were inundated. In particular, this one hospital that we worked with, the Shardaben Hospital, a slum community hospital, was inundated by patients, including babies in their neonate unit. The infant ward was really literally a brick oven with tar on the top, third floor. And the doctors that we spoke with told us how many babies died that day. The city was not ready. The hospital was not ready. With the interventions and the solutions we developed together, that hospital has since transformed. They moved the neonate ward to the bottom floor, and they created a two-room ICU AC unit. And now they make sure that not just that hospital, but both the public and private hospitals have ice packs.
So is it possible to provide much-needed air conditioning without using tons of power and also making climate change worse? Are people working on better solutions?
There's already been a global agreement that we were a part of achieving last November to phase down HFCs. HFCs are one of the six greenhouse gases, hydrofluorocarbons. The good news is companies, governments, organizations like ours agree that we can do it. The second part is innovation, making more efficient air conditioners so that the compressors and the processors are actually using the energy that they have more efficiently and using less energy, and decreasing the demand for air conditioning. And how do you do that? Through programs like cool roof programs, green building designs, so that the rooms themselves are staying cooler.
In this country, is your general sense that we air condition too much because we have it available and then we want things to be at 72 degrees and not maybe at 80 where we would be comfortable too?
Well, I could definitely nerd out with you on that for a long time. Thermal comfort and setting points. The air conditioning and your comfort level, what you acclimatize to, changes, right? So in India, the average Indian, and also if you just take an American and they're in India for a three-week period, their temperature setting will change in terms of what they're comfortable with. And part of what we discuss is ways to cool to at levels that we need to and have automated systems that gauge how many people are in the room, how to adjust to that. So technology can really work with us to enhance that. The thing about the United States is, right, that we have already built out and then we have to do retrofits, costly retrofits. In places like India, they can design smart from the start. They can design buildings, air conditioning units, and learn from the mistakes that we've made here in America. But what we're seeing is that as energy is a premium and saving energy and the drive to save energy is becoming a greater focus, that we can learn to do that here in the United States. Some places, yes, they do air condition too much. Technology is part of that, and behavior change is another part too.
That was Anjali Jaiswal from the National Resources Defense Council. Hot, dry weather often fuels increased wildfires in the western U.S., and researchers are finding that big fires can change the weather around them. And those meteorological changes, horizontal winds, water vapor, and updrafts, they make it tricky to know where fires are going next. Eilish O'Neill reports from Washington State.
Western Washington, where Seattle is known for rain. But in the east, near Spokane, it's a desert. The air smells of dust and pine trees, and when you walk across bare ground, each step sets off little clouds. The drainage ditches are dry and cracked. Ideal conditions for wildfires, which are common here. So, last summer, when a fire broke out on the Spokane Reservation where Danny and Noreen Wynn live, they weren't worried. They spent the early part of the evening watching flames on the unpopulated side of the reservation, confident that the fire couldn't cross the river to where they live. The river had always protected them before. But that Sunday, the fire jumped.
Somebody came up and said we had to get out of here. So I ran into the house and grabbed my great-grandchild and ran out to the pickup and jumped in the pickup.
Noreen and Danny's great-granddaughter, Dancer, lives with them. Noreen and Dancer, who's a toddler, left. Danny stayed.
And I was standing out here with a shovel and a garden hose like, you know, Smokey the Bear. And Blaine Keeper, one of our firefighters, he come right up the driveway and he looked at me. He said, Danny, you ain't gonna stop nothing with that. So I thought, yeah, you're right, it's coming pretty hard.
So Danny led his horses out and took off to join Noreen and Dancer. They spent the night in their pickups, a safe distance from the fire. Fire researchers are working to predict where wildfires are going to go next. They want to protect emergency workers and to know when it's time to tell people to evacuate and leave home. It turns out that's really difficult. Craig Clements is at San Jose State University. He says the trickiest part of predicting where fires are headed is that wildfires can actually make their own weather. Well, some people call it weather. Other researchers call it fire-atmosphere interactions. Whatever you call it, here's how it works. Fires change wind direction through fire plumes. That's the hot air shooting up from a fire. That hot air
can create like a low pressure around the fire front. And in response to that, what we call fire-induced winds can blow in from different directions.
Craig Clements and his colleagues now have fire-resistant equipment that they attach to planes that fly through fire plumes. So now they can get information about where air is moving and how fast it's going. They're hoping that plugging data into computer models will help improve those models for predicting future fires. Raging wildfires can also generate enormous amounts of smoke that drift downwind, and then...
Because the smoke is so dense, it blocks the sunlight. And so when that happens, you can actually get cooler air forming at the surface, and that cooler air wants to flow in different directions than otherwise would be on a sunny day.
That's another kind of mini weather system caused by fire. Wildfires can also create clouds. Burning plants release water vapor, and at the same time, fire plumes can pull vapor from the air. All that can condense into clouds, which can rain. Other times, the clouds can start to rotate, creating spinning winds that carry burning branches or even whole trees far from the fire, even across a river. Last year, on the Spokane Reservation, the spot where the fire left the river isn't too much wider than a two-lane street, but that's still a lot of water for a fire to cross. No one's sure exactly how that happened, but it may have had to do with fire-induced wind.
Wind kept changing, you know, shifting back and forth, and the fire goes with the wind.
The morning after the fire, Danny and Noreen went back to their land to look for their horses and take inventory. The horses were there waiting for them, but that was about all that was left.
We lost everything but the clothes we had on and our two pickups. We lost three cars, a tractor, our house. I just had new curtains put in my living room and just everything burnt to a crisp.
What are you most sad about losing?
My pictures.
I don't even like to talk about it. I'm the oldest daughter and I got all the Indian pictures of my great grandparents and stuff. They all burned up.
I see Mikey. He's coming to us.
I see him.
You see Mikey?
Danny and Dancer, she's 2.5 now, took me to see where their house used to be. Danny says the Spokane tribe will start laying a foundation on their new house soon.
You spend your life building a home. Fire just slows you down, just makes you more work for you. You gotta keep building. That's the way I look at it.
I'm rebuilding my collection here.
I can collect
So
walk.
This was at a family get together in April.
Noreen's busy rebuilding her family photo collection, getting copies from her daughter, and taking new pictures. This time, she's keeping her memories in a heart-shaped chocolate tin.
The story was reported by Eilish O'Neill.
Okay, let's put them back so they don't get ruined, okay? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, you're so sweet sometimes.
This is The Pulse, and we're talking about hot temperatures today. Sea turtles have been around for millions of years, so they've been through a lot of changes on our planet, and they've adapted to different climates. But the more rapid warming happening in recent history could be diminishing their populations. Climbing temperatures are changing sea turtle habitats and also potentially endangering their offspring. Females choose nesting beaches to lay hundreds of eggs in the sand, and the eggs and hatchlings are vulnerable to heat. Scientists are saying that sea turtles are now nesting on beaches further north, but that may not be enough. I talked to Vin Saba. He is a biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. What's a more dangerous, quote, place for a sea turtle to be, the ocean or the beach?
So in terms of climate impacts, I would say the nesting beach. And so the reason is it's because once those eggs are laid, they're static. They don't move. And so if the nesting beach starts to get warmer or drier or more rainfall, which could be negative or positive, you know, once they're laid, they're there unless humans intervene. In the ocean, as temperatures are warming or their prey is changing based on natural climate variability or climate change, there's at least room to adjust, whether you go to a different foraging area or now that temperatures have warmed in the ocean, now you can move further north because turtles are ectotherms. They're cold-blooded, so they do have to watch how warm or cold the water is. So there's more room for adjustment in the ocean than there is on land.
How are changing temperatures affecting the eggs themselves?
In terms of how the warming temperatures have affected what we're seeing today in terms of sex ratios and hatching success, because the sex of the hatchling is determined by the temperature at which it incubates at. So the warmer the nest temperature, more females are produced. The cooler the nest temperature, more males are produced. So in terms of any changes that we're seeing today, it's still hard to say. I mean, we've seen a northern migration where the females are nesting, but it's hard to say if we've seen any substantial impacts or say declines in the number of males produced or even in terms of hatching mortality, because the nests can also cook within the sand.
So before we even get to an all-female turtle society, we might have no turtles.
Correct. So initially, when sea turtle research first started thinking about climate change, the first instinct and the first thought that came to most scientists' minds was changing sex ratio, because most sea turtle populations are female biased. And so the assumption was, well, now you have 100% females and there wouldn't be enough males to continue recruitment.
Then, is that what you call it?
Right, recruitment. So recruitment into the population, new turtles. And so that's the biologist there. So, but then when we started doing tagging studies, what we found was that the male turtles were returning to the nesting beaches almost twice as much more often than females. So that was a way that the turtles have evolved to compensate for having more females than males in the population. So females would come back every 2 to 4 years. The males would come back every single year to breed.
They just work harder.
They just...
Yes. Insert jokes here.
Typical male, exactly. And that's what we now call the operational sex ratio, where the males come back twice as much as the females to compensate for that female biased ratio, which we think is just natural. So now that we know that, what we're thinking is, if we look at the lethal effects of just rising temperatures and in some cases drier conditions from less rainfall, we think that's going to be a bigger impact, just producing less baby turtles in general.
Anything humans can do other than hopefully reducing the climate change, but anything we could do to help the turtles?
We've done experiments, particularly some nesting beaches in Costa Rica, where researchers have actually shaded nests. So the eggs are buried about 2 to 3 feet below the sand surface, and you can actually shade the nest with inexpensive material and irrigate the nest with a sprinkler system like you would do your front lawn. And that actually keeps the nests wetter and also cooler. That in itself can simply reduce the nest temperature as air temperatures are warming, and then offset the effects of warming temperatures because you're cooling the nest via human mitigation.
And there are volunteers out there on the beach doing just that, protecting those nests. Vince Saba is a research fishery biologist for NOAA. Of us struggle in the heat, people and animals alike, but there are certain organisms that really thrive in hot temperatures. They're called thermophiles, heat lovers. And in the geysers of Yellowstone National Park, you can find all kinds of thermophiles, bacteria, viruses, fungi, living in water that's hot enough to blister your skin. Rebecca Huntington took a stroll around Yellowstone's most famous geyser to get a closer look.
Park Ranger Rebecca Rowland and I are lined up with more than 3,000 visitors, crowding in and all waiting with cameras. Yellowstone's most famous geyser, Old Faithful, shoots up columns of hot, steamy water about every 90 minutes. The water can be as hot as 204 degrees, and the steam can exceed 300 degrees. But to get a really good look at some of the thermophiles that make these geysers so colorful, we headed up the boardwalk to a less famous spot. Along the way, the hillside is covered in white mineral sand and looks like a moonscape. Hot water burbles like witch's brew, even making the ground thump like a drum.
So this is Pump Geyser.
It's like a mini Old Faithful, spitting out 4 to 5 foot high columns of water and then settling back down. As all the hot water runs down the hillside, it creates the perfect environment for heat-loving bacteria.
It has one of the most lush and prolific bacteria mats in the park.
Thermophilic bacteria are too small to see with the naked eye, but you can see them when they grow into colonies, called bacteria mats. From a distance, the mats look kind of like felt carpet, just under the water's surface. We bend over the boardwalk to get a closer look. It looks like an underwater forest of tiny Dr. Seuss trees.
So this bacteria mat is thick like a vegetable lasagna. You have a layer of slime and a layer of crunch and then a layer of slime and a layer of crunch. The crunch is the silica, the sinter, and the slime, of course, is the bacteria. And
this There's a whitish mineral deposit that lines the hot springs, kind of like white paint on a swimming pool. Scientists call it sinter.
Right at the center of each feature, where it's bright blue usually, that's where you have things like archaea and viruses that can grow above that 170 degree threshold.
Different temperatures cause different effects.
Below about 163 degrees, then you start in with the different types of bacteria, the thermophiles that like that really hot water, and you'll start in with a pale yellow color. And then you go out a little farther and you start heading into some of the darker peach colors. A little bit farther, you'll get some of the brighter oranges.
As you get further from the bright blue pool, the water begins to stream out like river channels, braiding back and forth across the white sandy soil.
And we've got runoff channels with streamers and colonies of bacteria there. I love the streamers, they're my favorite. The waving, it looks like feathers waving in the water.
Ranger Rebecca Rowland says the water in the runoff channels is about as warm as your bathtub, if you only turned on the hot water.
When you have a lot of water and it comes down from the feature and in varying grades of temperature, you get a lot of opportunity for varying organisms to grow.
It's like a living lab for scientists who've already identified many kinds of thermophiles living in Yellowstone's geysers. What they've found so far has already been useful.
In the past, they've actually found thermophiles that digested oil in oil spills. The enzymes that you use in your laundry detergent are heat tolerant because of original enzymes from Yellowstone.
Scientists love the park as much as tourists do, but the researchers, they're hunting for the next great breakthrough.
That's Rebecca Huntington reporting from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. Cancer pushes us. We push back. Cancer Treatment Centers of America is challenging conventional thinking and is working to find smarter solutions. With 5 treatment centers located throughout the United States, CTCA is forging ahead with technology that wasn't available to cancer patients just a short time ago. More at cancercenter.com/outsmart.
We're talking about heat on the show today, and yes, it's hot outside, but sometimes the heat is coming from within our bodies. A lot of women struggle with hot flashes during perimenopause or menopause.
So they stink. It's awful.
I have a slow burning that sort of progresses through my body.
Like you've just gotten dunked into a lava bath, a hot lava bath.
Sort of like when you preheat the oven to like 400 and then you open the oven to put whatever you're baking or cooking in and you get that rush of air on you. It feels like that.
Horrible night sweats.
Being woken by feeling super hot, kicking the covers off.
When I'm about to put my makeup on is when I feel like all of a sudden I'll break out into a massive amount of sweat, making my makeup just useless.
It's hard to get ready for work, to do your job, run a business, hang out with your friends and family when you're dripping sweat and your face is beet red. So what causes these terrible hot flashes? Researchers don't know that much about them, but Catherine Sharif, a doctor who specializes in women's health, told me they are associated with a drop in hormones.
Your sex hormones actually start to go down after age 35. Both estrogen and progesterone go down. Progesterone goes down faster, and then estrogen. But you may not feel any symptoms till later in your 40s.
How come? Is it a slow dip?
It's a very slow decline. We're actually supposed to reproduce right after we get our periods. That's what evolutionarily we were developed for that. And it's ironic that so many of us don't have children until after 35.
Right. So that's sort of like when we're supposed to be winding down.
Yeah. Or dying.
Oh, dying?
Well, you know, winding down, let's say.
Yeah. So we were not technically designed to be on the planet for as long as we are now.
Yes.
So in lieu of dying, many of us go on to live happy and fulfilled lives after the age of 35. Thankfully.
More or less.
Yes, more or less. Yes, I'm one of those specimens. So what exactly is going on in our body when we're having a hot flash?
We don't know the precise mechanism, but we do know this. Our body temperature is very tightly regulated. And when we go above a certain temperature, we begin to sweat. And when we go below a certain temperature, we begin to shiver to try to make ourselves warmer. What happens when our estrogen levels go down is that we lose regulation of that, what we could call a thermostat. So the thermostat is no longer tightly regulated. It may actually be very narrow. So now when your core body temperature goes up a little bit, not even half a degree, you actually start to sweat. So we're not doing such a good job with the thermostat. And we think it's controlled by estrogen and by neurotransmitters like norepinephrine and serotonin.
So what triggers a hot flash typically?
All day long, our body temperature goes up and down as needed, but we don't notice it. But when you don't have good control over the thermostat and the body temperature just goes up half a degree, then you break out into a sweat. So what you ordinarily wouldn't respond to before, you respond to now.
Is it almost like our body is going, alert, alert, you're too hot. Push, let's get some sweat going here.
Yes. So you have the sensation that the temperature is going up. You may feel some burning inside. You're hot and burning inside. And then your blood vessels dilate to try to dissipate the warmth. And you break it into, and it can be a copious sweat. And you know what else is interesting? The intensity of your hot flashes, the number of hot flashes, do not correlate with what your estrogen levels are in your blood.
Huh.
We know you have less, but it's not like, oh, if you reach 20, you go below 20, you've got hot flashes. But paradoxically, when we replace estrogen with fairly uniform levels that we give almost everybody, they're obliterated.
That seems to suggest some of us are simply more prone to them.
Yes.
Have we learned anything about who may be more prone?
We have absolutely no idea. The research is so scant. It's actually unbelievable. It's unbelievable that I have an iPhone computer in my hand, in my handbag, but we cannot map out what happens moment to moment, year to year, with hot flashes and how you correlate that with estrogen levels. It's just unbelievable.
It seems to me a lot of women who seek help for menopause-related issues are sort of told, well, that's just what it's like at your age, or it's just the way it is. We don't know. Why this lack of aggressiveness when it comes to treating something that really means a great burden for a lot of women?
Well, the root cause is sexism. Why would you study something that you don't think is important? And so it's been relegated to something that's not important.
Catherine Sharif is a women's health specialist at Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia, and she did say that in other countries there is some research happening on hormones that might eventually offer some clues. In Western medicine, we usually think of heat as a symptom. Fevers, hot flashes, hyperthermia, they are all indications that your body is under some kind of stress. In traditional Chinese medicine, there is a concept called internal heat, and reporter Liz Tung is here now to talk more about that. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Maiken.
And Liz, you have had some experience with internal heat.
Yeah, so I lived in China for a few years, and while I was there, I had it happen again and again that Chinese coworkers and friends would come up to me and forbid me from eating or drinking certain things because they said it would increase my internal heat.
Like what? What were you not supposed to eat?
So, for example, people would freak out if they saw me drinking ice water. That, paradoxically, increases your internal heat. Or if I had a cold, people would tell me, like, oh, you have to have some pears and apples because it'll soothe and cool down your body.
Did you ever figure out, though, what exactly internal heat is or does?
I never figured it out, but I recently visited a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner here in Philadelphia. Her name's Kara Frank, and no, she's not Chinese. Let's just get that out of the way. So she was exposed to traditional Chinese medicine back in the 70s when an acupuncturist helped treat her colitis. And later on, she went to China and studied it herself.
So what did she tell you about internal heat?
So the idea behind internal heat is that it's like a state of being out of whack, where the hot and cold forces in your body get out of balance. And that in turn can cause a whole bunch of different symptoms. So Kara let me sit in on a session with a new patient who has been suffering from all these stomach problems that doctors say is irritable bowel syndrome, but just hasn't been getting better no matter what she does. And Kara suspects she's suffering from internal heat.
All right, I got a whole lot of questions to ask you. So you're 32 and 25, you had your gallbladder removed, which is young.
Yeah, and 3 months later, I had my appendix taken out. Past 2 years, I've had horrendous diarrhea and nausea. My life has stopped, and the fact that every doctor is telling me it's just IBS, you have to deal with it. Here's another pill. I can't do it anymore.
Western medicine is based on deduction and reduction, right? You know, you have a symptom and you do all this diagnostic work and then you treat this symptom. But none of it is looking at this unifying, like what's happening underneath. So in Chinese medicine, we're viewing this much more holistically and in an integrative way. So her picture involves anxiety, nausea, diarrhea and abdominal pain. There's a lot of inflammation. That means we know there's heat.
Alrighty.
I think I have a lot of information. So now the real key is let's take a look at your tongue.
When somebody comes to my office, I ask a lot of questions and I listen to their story and then I examine their tongue and their pulse. All of this factors into our diagnosis, which is establishing a pattern. This tongue is a little too red and it's got a really thick coating and it's also very dry. So that tongue reflects a lot of heat, inflammation, and also even fluid retention.
Internal heat is one of the most ancient concepts in Chinese medicine, and it's based in the relationship of yin and yang. When is yin and yang formed? The minute a cell first divides at conception. Yang, the part of us that is warm and dynamic, comes in from the heavens and scoops down and creates this warmth in our body in the bottom. This is like our furnace. Then yin from the earth, food, is transformed into energy, right? And that keeps us alive. But this relationship gets screwed up in lots of ways. Stress is one of the biggest factors. Eating too fast, even overthinking can result in heat. And so all those conditions can cause different kinds of heat. There can be fulminant or excessive heat. Sometimes heat comes from stagnation. And then there's summer heat.
Wind heat.
Heat that is from an infectious disease.
Damp heat.
Heat that can affect the joints, causing inflammation.
Deficiency heat.
Heat that can exacerbate insomnia, anxiety, PMS. So that's a lot of heat. And so each one is going to get a different treatment and a different formula because it's affecting different parts of their body. But like in the case of this woman, her medical history, it's a big mess. But I don't have to tease apart a symptom. I'm treating, it's like a gestalt. This is her experience of her life, and it manifests in a particular way. So what I have to understand to get her better is I have to understand the overall pattern. And the key is balance. It's not just clearing heat, it's creating harmony.
That was traditional Chinese medicine practitioner Kara Frank. Liz Tong produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Alan Yu. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Tanya English is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.